netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is proudly brought to you by the new term at FXPhD.com with new Nuke, RealFlow, Houdini, Maya, Cinema 4D, Previz, and much, much more. Check it out now at FXPhD.com and take your career to the next level.
Thanks for joining us for this FX podcast. We produce several podcasts. This is the one where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. On this podcast, we like to dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. Please check out all of our podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Today, our interview is with VFX supervisor Mark Kolpak. Mark has worked on projects like Heroes, No Ordinary Family, and now the new Marvel TV show created by Josh Whedon, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. The show picks up the storyline after the Marvel film The Avengers, and Whedon is saying the show will weave in other past and future films in the Marvel Universe. We'll talk with Mark about some of the main visual effects shots and methodology from the pilot episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Before we get to that, the July 2013 term at FXPhD is wrapping up, which means the new term is about to be announced. As always, excitement is building to see what courses we have coming, so look for that announcement soon. FXPhD is our sister site that offers the best in online visual effects training. Come over to the site and meet some of the industry professionals who work as professors to share their knowledge and experience. You can keep up to date on software features and packages you know, or learn new skills and techniques. We invite you to check out fxphd.com and see what members around the world already know. FXPhD is an amazing resource to take your career to the next level. All right, let's get started. Here is Mike Seymour discussing Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. with Mark Kolpak.
So again, thank you so much for joining us. Really do appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to speak to you.
When did you first get involved with the project?
Oh, God, let's see. It was back in November of 2012. Part of the thing with television, and I'm a freelance visual effects supervisor, so I don't work for a facility. You know, I hire facilities. And it's kind of rare right now in television, although it's starting to swing the other direction. Look at this whole thing is so volatile. You know, it's either all houses and no freelancers, or it's freelancers and they hire houses and everything else. But I knew this was a big show, and I knew it would take the skills, you know, basically looking for the best attributes of different facilities and putting them together. So I went in, I finally got, you know, an interview. And we basically talked about, you know, my philosophy of visual effects and what I do. And they liked Heroes. I showed them my reel, which, of course, had a bunch of things from Heroes. And it had stuff from No Ordinary Family that I did as well. And they were like, this is great, great, great. And so I basically did a very hard sell.
Because No Ordinary Family had a lot of shots in it, didn't it?
A lot of shots, yeah. We did a lot of things. We had a guy who became fire. We had a guy who became mist. You know, I mean, it was a lot of really progressive stuff. I mean, the show, you know, for television, the show, of course, you know, didn't do well in the ratings, and it was canceled after the first season. But there was quite a lot of stuff that I did there. And I had been using digital doubles since doing Heroes, when everyone thought you can't do that on television, and digital makeup as textures to create, you know, tracking it onto digital doubles and match moving and roto animating on top of the actors and all kinds of things that people thought I was nuts, and trying to convince them as to why they should go with a guy like me. And my thing was, like I said, a show of this kind of importance and the fact that it's Marvel's first 1-hour dramatic television show for primetime requires someone who is going to make a product for them that is going to be indistinguishable from their feature product. This audience expects a certain level of storytelling and visual dynamics that has to transcend into the television arena. And if you don't do that, they're going to see it as the lesser of, and people are going to fall away from it.
I mean, that is the harsh thing, isn't it? You've got this. Let's face it. I mean, this has nothing to do with anything but just sheer economics. The films are some of the most successful films of all time, and thus have incredibly large budgets and very serious production schedules. And you're competing against
that. Absolutely, they do. Yeah, absolutely. And so you got to say, you know, because back when I started doing Heroes, you know, I said, I'm going to do feature for television visual effects. And that became my sort of moniker. He's the guy that does feature for television visual effects. And now I said, I'm up in the ante. Now I'm going to do Marvel feature for television visual effects, which is quite a tall order, you know, to strive for. And I said, I have one show that I'm competing with in terms of my mind. There's one other show on the air that I feel is our sort of bar that we have to meet or exceed, and that's Game of Thrones. So perfection is kind of a good thing and a bad thing, because, you know, obviously in television we don't have 18 months to shoot a movie, you know, to post all the visual effects. You know, we don't have all this prep time beforehand to do all this R&D. I've always joked that sometimes my R&D time is driving from home to the studio and I'm figuring out stuff, because there just isn't that prep time. If you do get a day or two, wow, what a luxury that is. And, you know, I had taken it upon myself to do a breakdown, you know, which I came in at about 215 shots. It didn't become that in the end. We had 130. Due to careful planning and everything else and choices that Joss wanted to make. But I did like about 215 shots in the initial breakdown. Handed that to them. Interview went fine. So I got the call. I got the job. It was something like about a week or so later. And we started shooting end of January, and we started prepping in beginning of December. And I'm incredibly grateful, because it is such a dynamic group. Very rarely in this industry that we're all a part of, do you ever really get to be on special projects?
So I wanted to ask you about approaching the project, because a very good writer once said that a film reveals its characters, but TV shows get to explore them. And I was thinking about this in terms of your work, and I was thinking, well, you really need to set up a bunch of stuff that you can use throughout a series. But given that this project had so much juice behind it going in, I was imagining that you might be able to invest a bit more in, say, asset creation and building stuff up, because you knew you were going to be exploring these places, assets, things later.
So basically, yeah, when you go into a television project, movies are like a one-off unless you have a sequel. So everything has to sort of begin, middle, and end, wrap up in 2 hours or less. In television, if you're lucky enough, you're doing 22, 23 hours on a one-hour drama. So assets are created and amateurized because we know we're going to reuse them over and over again. Sometimes things will change on the assets depending upon what they are. But ultimately, yeah, you're sort of planning ahead, and a lot of things sort of get constructed in the pilot that will be used again either in every episode or occasionally in some other ones. So, but the thing about it is that what you really get to do is if an ability or something is part of a certain character, you can evolve that. The writers can evolve that, and either make something escalate, make something decrease. What I always do, which is I think, you know, the way I always look at this stuff is if we're dealing with a character who has an ability, let's say it's just a born ability, the person is a super of some sort. What I always try to do is work with the actor to create the proper genesis of where this ability comes from internally. You know, is it cellular? Is it just pure chemistry running through someone's bloodstream? What is the catalyst that activates this? What is the visual motion or performance that the character needs to do to make this feel like it is integrated with his character and his performance and not something that just sits on top? So I'm very careful with always doing that. I did it on Heroes and on Ordinary Family, and I'm doing it now on this show. I feel it always helps to make the world that they live in more believable. And most importantly, if you make these kind of things happen in that manner, what you get is something that hopefully the audience is not thinking too much about. They just accept it for what it is as part of the character and not saying, oh, look at his power. Well, that's not my goal. My goal is to be invested in the character, and what they do is something that the audience is just like, wow, you see what that character did? Wow, he did that, he did this. You know, I was really caught up in that. That's what you wanted. Or the best thing of all, no one even notices.
You mentioned digital doubles before, and
yes.
I remember on Heroes, you know, you just basically got every character digitally scanned because you knew sooner or later you'd have to kind of use them. Is the same true now with S.H.I.E.L.D.? You just bother getting every single actor digitally doubled because...
Almost. You know, it came here. Here's what's funny. The origin for using digital doubles came to me on Heroes because I was faced with a certain challenge. And that was Adrian Pastar's character needed to fly. And I like to do things where it's look, ma, no hands. And I mean, things happen without a cutaway, you know? So I sat there and I thought, how am I going to pull this off? Because I can put a guy in a harness and I can lift him up and I could DVE him, but that doesn't look as good. I could puppeteer him. I could put that performance in a 3D card and I could manipulate that card, but it's still not 3D. You're still limited. So one night I was hanging out and there happened to be this retrospective of Superman. And I said, oh, I'm watching that because I'm just such a comic book guy. So I'm like, I got to watch this, you know? So the whole thing from like the 30s on up, right? The movies, where he was and this and that. So in one of the movies early on, I forgot what year it was, but it was an older movie. Probably like around the 40s or somewhere, the producers were faced with the same challenge. How do we get Superman to take off in one shot into the sky? And I'm watching this going, wow, this is my problem. So my eyes are glued to the television set, and I'm seeing, and they go, well, what they did is the actor did his performance, he jumped into the air like Superman, and then they transitioned to a cartoon, to an animation. And he flew away. And I went, oh, my God, there's the answer, digital double. I went, that's what I got to do. And, you know, when I proposed this in one of our, you know, concept meetings, you know, and even when, you know, at the time I worked for Stargate, I was literally, you know, faced with people looking at me like, that can't be done. And I'm like, dude, this is going to be so awesome. You have no idea how cool this is going to be. So I contacted Nick Tessie at the time, and he still does my scanning today. And so I worked with Adrian because the challenge there was for his performance was like everything – we see characters fly all the time, but mostly they're Superman, you know, postures. How do we do this? So I said we got to make – Adrian said, we got to make your performance a flight – unique to you. How can we do this? You know, what do you see here? And he's like, all right, stand back. Let me see what I can come up with here. Let me see how this feels right to me. You know? And so I'm standing there and he's, you know, in his pajama bottoms with no shirt on, you know, and he just jumped, looked upward and put his hand straight down. And I went, wow, that is cool. He goes, that's it. And so that's what we did. And he got a lot of height for him too. It's amazing. I couldn't believe how much vertical lift he can get. And then we just, boom, right to the digital double. And then one of the things I wanted to do with that particular moment, because the script, I can't remember exactly what the narrative described, but it was something like, you know, talking about Nathan Petrelli being backed up, and before anyone can say, this is the coolest show on the air, boom, he takes off into the sky. So I'm like, okay, so he's got to take off. I said, I want him to hit stage two and create basically like someone breaking the sound barrier where planes break it and they make the shock ring. So I had found reference of a volcano in the Antarctic that was belching these rings of smoke. And the texture and everything was exactly what I was looking for. So I showed the guys in 3D and... boom, he shoots up, and then in the air, woof, hit stage two, created the shock ring with a little bit of atmospheric drag, and gone. And it was just like cool. And ever since then, been using digital doubles to solve these sort of, you know, challenges, whether you've got to kick a guy who, you know, he's super powered, he kicks someone and guy flies back, you know, 20 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet, 200 feet, whatever it might be, or someone can jump from the street to the building, all this kind of stuff. It's always been digital doubles. And in this show, when we, you know, we have a scene where this character, Mike, rescues a woman from a burning building. And, you know, we got to that and I broke it down digital double. And so we were having the meeting about it, and I'm telling Joss, and he's looking at me like, I don't know, you know, and the production's like, I don't know about that either. I go, guys, this is the way to do it. I'm telling you, I do this all the time. It's going to be brilliant. I'm going to put more effort into making this look so incredibly real because of the nature of the project and it being Marvel and everything. It's going to be indistinguishable from the actor. Absolutely. I promise you that. And even on a date when I'm tech scout, okay, so we'll put a descender rig here. You know, I'm going, really? So I gave them, you know, some examples of the digital doubles I've done. They were like, wow, that's pretty cool. And I said, okay. And so, boom, the crane was out for the center rigs, the stunt, blah, 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 everything like that. And they went with me on it. Scanned Jay, who played Mike, and also Shannon, who played Debbie, the character he rescues. And then sent it over to Fuse, because Fuse Effects is the lead house. The four houses that I had on the pilot was Fuse, COSA, Luma, and Furious. So that's where I spread the work around, and like I said, Fuse was the lead. Luma jumped in and did the holographic recreation, which is in the show in the cargo hold, and then other work was spread around accordingly. But so I gave him the model, you know, of both the actors, made it incredible, you know, sort of absolutely put the time into all the textures and everything else, And then when we shot it, you know, basically I stitch everything. And what I mean is that, you know, we have a building that just blew up. We have fire coming out, and there's going to be a secondary explosion just as the actor or the actors leap from the building. So the low angle looking up is digital double transition to actors below. So you know, we basically had the performance and what we wanted for Jay and Shannon, you know, landing where he's holding her, which was extremely difficult for him because, you know, most of the times we do this, it's just the actor and they can run and jump in the air and then land on their mark. And that's what we take for our transition piece for their landing. Or if they take off, they jump. But here he had the whole, you know, 105-pound girl and jump. He didn't get very much height. And then he had the whole, you know, the heroic pose, you know, and then he thought he could put his knee down. And then Josh was like, no, 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 I don't want that. That shows weakness. I want your knee to not touch. Oh my God. That was even harder. So we had to keep going until he could do it without his back leg shaking. And so he's a strong guy, mind you, but it's still, you know, that's a bit challenging, you know, and then he sets her down. So once we got that, then it was a matter of doing, you know, overlaps. We go up, you know, have a 30% overlap between framing and then up again and then up again. And then we got all the way to the top of the building. So I was basically stitching in reverse and then we held and then we blew the secondary explosion. And then the reason why I stitch things is because if you make a move, you know, normal, you know, tilt up or down, what happens is that, you know, you're locked to that timing. If you speed it up, the environment and things in it speed up as well. If you stitch things, you have complete control to create, you know, the tilt down or tilt up or pan in post without ever affecting the speed of the environment within the actual frame. So it allows me to do that. So did the thing transition, boom, and it's amazing. And then of course we had a little bit of coverage on top with some green screen where the stunt guys jumped out and did stuff and recreated explosion up there. You know, and, you know, it looked amazing. I mean, it lands and we cracked the ground and added some dust and you know, Joss and everyone became a believer. You know, it was a big explosion, which was practical, done by Gary D'Amico, who's an amazing special effects coordinator. here in the land of television. And I mean, it was really impressive. I mean, it's just, I mean, when you, I mean, it's in the pilot. I mean, it's in the trailer. So if you watch the trailer at all, you can see that, that building explode, you know? So that's, so I was going to augment that. I had that in our budget to augment. He blew that thing. And I'm like, all right, money to use somewhere else. You know, nothing needed.
So, I was wondering if some other stuff transferred from Heroes in terms of your experience. Because, I mean, I remember in Heroes you did really good digital makeup of, say, Claire Burning.
Yes, I did.
And I was wondering if that translated into stuff you're doing with Extremis in S.H.I.E.L.D.
What's interesting is that was another moment in Heroes where everyone looked at me again like I was smoking crack. Because we set, the problem was this, was that we have the, we had this scene described in Heroes where it says, you know, she goes in, she has to, what was the character's name? I can't remember
Claire?
The character's name. No, there was Claire, but the guy that she had to stop, Scrag or something. The unfortunate nuclear man that was blowing up, she was the only one who can get close enough to him to inject him with a syringe and subdue him. But the place blows up, and she's supposed to come out and be completely charred and then, you know, heal up.
Yep.
So I sat there, you know, and Alan Arkus was the director of that episode, and I said, we should do this like the T-1000, you know? She comes out, and it's all one shot. Because they were planning on doing, you know, they were going to have, you know, two doubles for Claire on set with two different, you know, severities of makeup. One really bad, one kind of bad, and then there would be Claire just kind of sooty.
Yep.
And I said, I said, you know what, here's a problem. With all due respect, I said, doubles don't move or perform like your actors. They just don't. I said, you know, Hayden, she might be just walking, but she's doing 100 things mentally in that walk that's going on. Someone doubling her is just going to walk. They're not going to get her performances, the nuances, the things that make her performances so great. I said, so here's my idea, guys. I say we shoot it where she comes out, and everyone say, well, you can't put textures. I said, no, I'm not getting rid of your textures. I said, the special effects makeup. I said, I'm taking those incredible textures of that makeup, and we're going to put them on her at another date. I'm going to photograph them as textures. We're going to basically put them onto her digital double, roto-animate and track them onto her, and this way she can walk out and heal right before our eyes. And everyone looked at me like, again, like I was smoking crack. And they go, and I was like, well, I don't know, you know, I think we should still have the doubles there and everything else. I said, fine, have the doubles there. Let's see. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. You know, if they do a great job, terrific. But I said, the power of this show and the power of what we're doing is not hiding it with cuts, you know, between these different three girls. So we get out to shoot, and of course, you know, Hayden does her performance. Great, got that. Okay, Alan says, now bring in the double number one. Comes out, I'm at my monitor, Alan's at his over to my right. Double comes out. He goes, cut. He looks at me and he goes, fuck. They don't match. I smiled, okay. He says, well, let's do it one more time. And so take two. Doesn't match. And he looks at me. I said, Alan, digital makeup. It's going to be awesome. You see, it's going to be fantastic. And he goes, okay, we'll go your way. and that's what we did. So, yeah, so everything that sort of, you know, everything is a compilation. You know, I always like to say, I like to pick up one jewel. If I can just get one jewel from every single, you know, project that I'm on, it's been well worth it. And everything is a collection that I put into my toolbox of visual effects to use, to manipulate, to enhance, to adjust later on. So, that shapes my perspective on things. It shapes my confidence in what I do and what I say I can't do. And to be honest with you, I say a lot of things. Even if I'm not entirely sure, I know it can be done and I figure out a way. But ultimately, what I did in Heroes was the reason why I ended up on No Ordinary Family. Because David Semel directed the pilot of Heroes.
All right.
And he directed the pilot of No Ordinary Family. And so I had worked briefly, I mean really briefly, on some reshoots on the pilot of Heroes with him. And then I readjusted some of the work on the pilot of No Ordinary Family, just fine-tuned some things. But it was because of that, because they wanted to do what that show did visually. So I said, fine, I'll be glad to. And we took it to the next level, you know, and the next level was doing better digital double work than I had done on Heroes, which was good, but there was room for improvement. Doing character animation in particles. You know, we had a fluid. Basically, we had a guy who became mist. And that mist had to have a performance. So even though in some things it was anthropomorphic to a degree, you know, it was articulating it in different ways to you know, sort of maneuver through the scene in a way that felt like the character, you know?
So
that was something.
But I was curious whether those digital makeup approaches were something that you brought to S.H.I.E.L.D.
We haven't done any of that yet.
Okay.
You know, this show is about ordinary people who have to go deal with some extraordinary things. So as Josh has said, it's the every man's, you know, storyline, and we haven't had anything yet where we've had to do that. We almost did it on an episode that we're currently working on, but it's not going in that direction. You know, sort of, you know, everything evolves, and
sure,
during the shooting it kind of evolved, but yeah, so the makeup, you know, hasn't really happened. Although you know, there's something coming up. I can't talk about it, but you know, yeah. I'll say it this way: there could be something, you know.
One of the things I understand about the pilot is or the crew actually got to shoot some actual stuff in Paris. Is that correct?
Yeah.
The reason I asked that is that I love the matte paintings that you did in Heroes, and I was obviously there is a trend in the industry to doing digital backlot approaches of shooting.
Sure.
Actors in green screen. I was wondering if you could comment on that, because it was extraordinary. You actually went to get real stuff in Paris.
Highly unusual. I actually questioned if it was going to actually happen, you know, because the script initially took place in San Francisco for the primary location, and then you know, this opening in Paris, and we ended up shifting San Francisco to Los Angeles, and Joss, no, we're going to Paris. And you know what? I got to tell you something. It's brilliant, because it changes the whole tone of what you see, you know, after that. I mean, it just opens the scale of the world that we're going to be a part of. And we're still doing that, you know, to some degree now, you know. That wasn't just a pilot one-off, you know. The show has some extraordinary locations that are not U.S. bound, and where we can double it effectively, locally, we do, and where it's absolutely unique and necessary, we go elsewhere. So it really gives it sort of this global perspective for the show. And I'm sorry, you know, you can do the digital backlot, you can do the Lightcraft virtual thing, which is okay. I love what Lightcraft can do as a tool. I'm not convinced of it as a means to pull off incredibly realistic locations in a short time frame for series television. It can do some great, you know, data collection for you and whatnot, and it's really interesting, but it's something that I haven't totally, you know, embraced to utilize. There might be a possibility for it later on, but the thing is that you can, you know, and it's necessary to do set extensions, to put yourself in another world and in another location, another you know, city, another country, whatever. But the thing is that the light looks different in all of these places.
Yeah, that is really a European light is, you're absolutely right, isn't it? It just does look different.
It's entirely different. It's entirely different, and you can't duplicate that. No matter how you grade a film, you sit in with your power windows and your secondary color correctors and everything else, right? I'm sorry. There is a uniqueness to the different areas of this planet.
But you must be anticipating a bunch of green screen or blue screen at some point, just for the sheer...
Sure, sure. I mean, I'm going to have some on the one that we're prepping now on episode 107. You know, we're going to have some...
Do you shoot green or blue, by the way?
Well, it depends. It depends. Blue is a noisier channel, but if I have a blonde actress, like I had with In Ordinary Family with Julie Benz,
yep.
Always blue. I always shoot my blonde actors or actresses on blue, because the problem is that blonde hair being it the green gets into the filament of the hair, and I'm really careful with my screens. No matter how much I have tried to basically suppress that green on set with either filters or warmer light or whatever can justify, that green gets in there and it's really hard to get it out, and you end up tinting the hair back and it's a mess. So the blue works much more effectively with blondes. But of course, you know, you get a bit of it's blue's a noisier channel. But, you know, I basically set my blue screen a half stop above my shooting key, and green I'll bring a half stop below key, you know, because it's just a lot more powerful.
And what camera are you shooting on?
On the pilot, it was an interesting, we've shifted. On the series, we're using the next generation Alexa.
Right.
Which does 120 frames per second, which is terrific. I've been an Arri guy for a long time, and we used the first generation Alexa on No Ordinary Family, but I had a lot of challenges with it on blue and green screen. There was no separation. It was a very shallow curve in the color spectrum, and so therefore, if you the blue was so, the chip basically had a situation where if you pulled green, it pulled blue because the values of green and blue were so close numerically together. So it was difficult. The new Alexa is brilliant. It's fantastic. They solved all of those issues and everything.
I presume that you're recording to something like a codex or the Arri codex, because if you're doing the keys and stuff, you wouldn't be doing ProRes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all, I mean, we're shooting 2K.
Right.
You know, 2K raw. So yes, it's an HD, you know, 1920x1080 show, but we're doing all 2K, and my vendors are all working off of 2K plates.
Right. And so you're getting those raw files and then just distributing those into whatever. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Exactly. Exactly. No. So on the pilot, David Boyd, brilliant DP, also a director. Now, you know, he's off directing things, but he came on and he shot Firefly with Joss, so they have a history together. And so David called me, and he's a wonderfully energetic, charismatic character, and you know, very talented DP. And so he calls me up and introduces himself, which was a complete shock, because I've never had a DP ever call me before a project began to introduce himself to me. And he says, I'm traveling right now. I've got 40 seconds to talk to you. And I said, okay. So I started talking real quickly, and the phone went dead. Literally, I felt like it was like 40 seconds. I went, wow, he wasn't kidding. You know, turns out he just lost cell reception. But it was coincidentally timed perfectly. So we ended up saying, he said, look, how do you feel about anamorphic? I said, I don't want to do anamorphic. That's just going to be a problem, squeezing and unsqueezing and television and doing a pilot and compressed schedules and everything else. And, you know, we could have issues between the different houses, and I'd rather stay away from that. He says, well, you know, I got to tell you, it's like I just want to take some of the sharpness out of the digital thing. And I said, okay. And I said, he said, what camera do you like? I said, I like the Red Epic. I said, I've had some great work. It has, you know, the X channel for the secondary, you know, channel of HD that you can, you know, set, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of really great things about that. It can go 300 frames per second. That's great. He says, let's do a camera test. And I said, okay, let's get the Alexa and let's get the Red Epic. And what do you think about putting a super 16 millimeter lens on these bodies? I said, really? And so we basically Frankensteined the camera together. We tested the Alexa with the 16, but it really just, you know, you had to blow the image up way too much and it just, degradation set in and it just fell apart. But you can shoot 2K with the Super 16 zoom, because his concern was this, twofold. One, it was taking the sharpness off of the elements, so therefore, you know, they looked more cinematic and film to him. And two, he needed a lens with all the speed that we were going to be moving at, that he would have the range of focal lengths at his disposal in one lens. And that was, and that gave it to him. He could go really super wide, and he can go telephoto pretty long.
So which lens was it?
It was the, it's hard to figure out because everything is, of course, you know, 6 millimeter, which is a 12 millimeter lens. So it was like a 12 to a 2 something. I can't remember the actual full length of it. You know, but I can find out for you if you really, you know, want to know. But yeah, but it was a Super 16 lens, and it worked. And you know, it did what he wanted it to do. For me, you know, when we had to do certain comps and certain CG objects went in, there was a noticeable difference for me in the sharpness and trying to make, you know, the element that we shot fit into either the background plate or the CG element that would be around it, let's say. And so therefore, you know, I think it looks all great and everything timed really well. It's all beautiful. You know, my thing was, let's go back to 35 millimeter lenses on the series if the show gets picked up. And that's what we've done. And it's just, so now we're using the Alexa 35 millimeter lenses. We have Felix Parnell and Jeff Mygat, I guess.
Now, I understood that if you went to the 120 frames, which obviously is great on the Alexa, you couldn't record RAW. You could only record that 120 frames in like 422 ProRes HQ or DNX HD. Is that right? I mean, or did you? Am I wrong on that?
No, I have not seen. I mean, we have, as far as I'm concerned, we're still at the RAW. Maybe it drops to 444, but definitely not 422.
Okay.
As far as I know, I mean, the ones that we're using, I have not noticed a bit of difference in anything. So color space hasn't changed or, you know, whatsoever. So, you know, otherwise, 422 and shooting high speed against, you know, screens would, you know, make it a little bit more problematic, you know, pulling keys and everything else. And of course, you know, you live and die by the keys that you pull.
In the show, there are, for example, gadgets and stuff that clearly are going to be CG kind of elements and stuff. What are you capturing on set and giving to your – what is your team capturing on set and giving to your animating post houses to pull those things off?
A few things, actually. You know, all the props – Scott Bauer is our property master, and he's been making some really spectacular – props, I have to say. I mean, it's spectacular in the sense that just not to, you know, say, hey, look at this, all great. No, the guy has put an incredible amount of artistic thought into even the briefcases. For instance, we have, seriously, when you open the briefcases, you know, the whole syringes or the nano quadcopters, it's just not an open, you know, briefcase and there's some, you know, sort of velvet, and it's just sitting. No, these things all have like either they're aluminum and they're bent in a way, and they hold things. Just there's an incredible amount of art and time put into creating these things. And that being said, for instance, Scott designed the nano quadcopters that we have in the show, and better known as the drones. The drones are all named after the seven dwarves because dwarf in our show stands for something, but I can't remember. So, you know, I mean, obviously S.H.I.E.L.D. is filled with sort of anagrams and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, but so we have these seven nanos and they go around and they collect certain, you know, data from certain either crime scenes or supernatural events. And then the team is able to then later on back at the lab, you know, either display it, on either monitors Or in the pilot's case, you know, we had the holographic recreation scene, which was done by Luma Effects. But before I talk about that, the props, you know, I get OBJs from them because they're designing everything in a 3D program that they use, which is, I forgot which program they use. It's something I never heard of before. Obviously, it's not a CAD kind of thing, but it's something that they use like that. And then they go to 3D printers and they make the molds, or they make the product and they make the mold from that. So whenever I need something, whether it's, you know, to duplicate it because it starts in one way and then becomes 3D somewhere else, he gives us the OBJ. If we need to remodel it in Max, it gets remodeled. But at least it gives us something to clean up and work with. So there's quite a great deal of amount of sharing between, you know, departments. I work closely with Scott. I work closely with Greg Melton, the production designer, because, you know, we're both sharing, creating certain worlds. His sets begin in one place, and then I help to extend them in beyond that. So it's important to keep that communication going. And then, you know, the holographic, you know, recreation, or the holograph recreation scene was something that was going to be challenging, but not something that was impossible to achieve, but just, you know, how do we make this thing visually look like something different? And so therefore I was really a big fan of the work on Prometheus.
Right.
So Prometheus became sort of a blueprint for that whole, you know, alien, you know, sort of cosmic world that they had, that sort of map of the universe.
Yeah, kind of like a lighter look at
yeah,
stuff.
Exactly. Yep. So we ended up saying, okay, well, that was the blueprint. So I started to test, you know, a few different houses, and Luma had reached out to me and said, hey, you available to come down and look through the place and see what you're doing? And I kind of had my mind set on two other houses who were going to do a test for me, just some style frames, to make sure that they were able to artistically execute what their words were saying, you know. And the same went when I went down to Luma and I sat with them, and I was very impressed with their whole operation and how tight everything was, and how, you know, even just when we sat in the meeting and they had someone taking notes, and I said, these people got their act together. And then I knew that they did Prometheus, but I kind of thought, you know, they're going to be too expensive. They're a feature house. So I said, okay, here's the deal, guys. I shoot really straight. So you'll never get any bullshit from me. This is a television pilot. There's one sequence that I think you would excel at in a big way. And that's this holograph recreation sequence. And they said, oh, sounds great. And I told them what it was. They were like, oh, that'd be awesome. So I said, listen, just give me a style frame, you know, and everyone else is doing the same thing, and so on. So, you know, the style frames came in, and I was, of course, blown away by Luma's. And the other two were fine, but Luma stood out. But I said, I'm not going to make this about my choice. You know, I'm going to show Josh. So I said, Josh, here are the three style frames. He goes, boom, boom, boom. And he picked exactly who I knew. He goes, Luma. Luma wins. I said, okay. So they bid it, and I got their bid. And, of course, it was feature level, you know, amount. But I said, guys, I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to tell you the price range that television works in for mandate rates, because I would love for you to do the show. But I said, you know what? I respect a no as much as I respect a yes, sometimes more. Because I don't want it. Because if you say yes, I don't want to hear excuses later that you can't pull it off, or the dollars and the time and everything else. I'd rather you say, you know what, we would love to be a part of it. We can't fit into our pipeline or budget to put the proper, you know, the necessary assets to make it successful. So I said, here are the ranges, and you tell me. I said, this is how much I've allocated for this particular sequence. And I said, and my producer, Sabrina Arnold, who is absolutely a godsend. I said, so I said, Sabrina, what do we have? She said, we have this. And she says, well, actually, we have a little more. I said, I'm going to give you the higher number. I said, and come back to me. And they said, a few days went by, and they came back, and they said, we'll do it for that number. And they absolutely just excelled, you know, and it worked. And we ended up basically having two different, you know, light setups. One, because the hologram was from a lab in another scene that was highly, you know, high key lit, you know, because it had windows and everything else and fluorescence and whatnot. And then we were in our darker, moodier cargo hold where the hologram equipment is. So we ended up, you know, having one set of lighting for our actors. Then we did digital doubles on both characters, just because, you know, I could not use motion control, you know, and we had some moves and some things. And even though, you know, I used witness cameras as well to try to see if we could capture some of the information, did all my HDRIs and whatnot. And then Luma came out and said, yeah, we want to scan the set. So we put, you know, it was something like I don't know how many days later it was, but we put everything back to the way it was. Not exactly registered the same, but it didn't matter. It was close. And they scanned everything, and it just was absolutely...
Now, that's the set it's going into, or that's the set that they were reproducing as the hologram?
It was what we did is Joss wanted to have set pieces that would have existed in the lab. See, because when our characters come to it, it's that in the opening of the trailer when you see that explosion.
Yep.
It's that lab. And so the lab is no longer there. So the thing was, do we build a lab that we LIDAR and then use as a virtual environment, or do we just make it 3D and forget about building it, because why build a set that you're never going to shoot in?
Yeah.
And that was and that was wasteful to me. I said, no, we're not going to build a set that we're never going to, you know, put cameras in. That's ridiculous. And then Joss kept refining how much he wanted to see of what. So it was like, okay. Then he said, because I was going to have to like make, you know, I was going to basically photograph our set that was burnt out and destroyed, and then recreate textures prior to its explosion. And then Joss said, you know what? I don't need to see the walls in the hologram. I'm going to have the actors, a few desks, equipment. That's it. And so we ended up basically doing two passes on everything, but no screens, so it was a lot of roto. You know, but we would basically, you know, shoot the actors, you know, the lab tech and the other individual, and then we would broom the set away, and then we would have, you know, our cast do their bit of it in that particular setup, bring the lab equipment back in, put it back into place, and it worked out very successfully, I have to say. It was great. And then, of course, you know, I came in, they LIDAR'd, you know, things, so they had all the pieces, and this way we could have dynamics when things broke apart. There was, you know, returning edges on stuff and all kinds of things. So because the explosion, we see what happens in the actual lab along with the actual scene. So
just to finish that up,
sure.
Can you just give me like a quote on, you know, how did Josh kind of react to that final sequence when it was done?
Oh, he loved it. I mean, because what we did is we ended up mixing a little bit of Prometheus with a little bit of the first Matrix, you know? So it really has an electronic feel. And, you know, it's funny. Joss doesn't go around going, oh, this is incredible. It reminds me of this, this, and this, or that, that, and that. He just will say, great. Love it. Terrific. You know? And if he doesn't, you know, it's usually like, that looks clumpy or something, you know. I mean, it's just, I don't like the way that looks. That's not really working, you know. And he, you know, you just kind of get where he's vibing with stuff and where he isn't. And, you know, he hires, it's funny. I mean, a lot of people don't do this, but he definitely, when you are part of one of his projects, if he's hired you, He selected you. He's empowering you and trusting you to do your job. He's not there to do your job for you, you know, and nor does he have time to do it. The guy is so incredibly busy. So, you know, I would just keep showing him stuff, and he would say, yeah, well, that's great. Give me a little bit more of this, you know. But I'm telling you, it was, you know, very sort of easy and not a whole lot of dialogue with him. He sort of keeps it to a minimum.
So
he likes to talk about a lot of other things.
In general terms, is that pilot experience being mirrored going forward with the other reps without going into the details of any of the plot lines? I mean, it's a sort of a similar experience moving forward?
Yes. I mean, you're not going to see a pilot that looks like a movie and then the next episode looks like a television show. You know what I mean? The stylistic narrative and the quality that you see in the pilot is continuing on into each episode. So, you know, with the stories, with cinematography, with the visual effects, with the costuming, with the props, everyone is trying to maintain and uphold the look that was established in the pilot.
So, in just finishing up, I just would be completely remiss if I didn't ask you about what has already become, even though the show hasn't aired, you know, a complete fan favorite, which is Lola. Did you get to scan the car? Did you get to touch Lola?
Yeah. Lola is awesome. I can't talk. Lola's a special item. But I will say Lola is bitching.
Good. Well, as long as it doesn't disappoint.
Lola is bitching. I'm telling you, Lola is no disappointment.
Brilliant.
You know, and later on, you know, if there's ever more to talk about that you guys feel, you know, you want, you know, and we're able to talk about other items at that point, then we could fill in on the details of those things.
Yeah, well, actually, I'd love to take you up on that. At the end of the series, and I have a feeling that we might be talking to you, especially around Emmy's time next year, but at the end of the series, let's loop back and I can discuss some of the details of what you guys have managed to pull off in detail, having had the series go to air. But I do appreciate you taking time to talk to us now. And where are you, like, in the schedule? Are you still in the middle, flat out of, like, production, I presume?
Oh, yeah. No, the show was picked up for 12 episodes, including the pilot. So we're doing 11. We air September 24th. The pilot will air. And we're prepping. Today's first day of episode 106, or the sixth episode, and we're starting to prep 7. And I say, you know, hopefully we'll find out sometime before we even get to episode 7 if we're picked up for a full season for the back 9, which I would expect. There's a lot of anticipation for the show.
Yeah.
And I really feel the show delivers extremely well. So I hope we get picked up at the back 9, and we'll continue the conversation. But
How long does your team, once it hits, once there's turnover from editorial, how long does the teams have to complete an ep? Is it a fortnight? Is it 3
basically,
weeks?
Basically, we officially have 12 days, right?
Okay.
So, but I don't start at picture lock. I generally start isolating in prep which sequences or shots are going to need extra time. So by the time the editor turns over his or her cut, I start pulling stuff. And I always figure that at that point, the shots are the longest they'll ever be. And they'll always trim them or delete them later, get rid of them, just submit them. But ultimately, I try to start around then. And now, and if I start around the editor's cut to the director's cut in that range, I end up giving myself about 20 days an episode. Right now, obviously, we've had a little bit of luxury, but of course, you know, time will catch up to us, time in broadcasting episodes. So it's going to get more and more of a crunch, you know. And initially, the studio had requested us to have the first 10 available to be seen without interruption, no preemption, nothing. Which that's a pretty tall order, I have to say. I've never done 10, and it kind of made all of our knees buckle a little bit, because you know something always has to sacrifice if you're up against it, and I don't like to sacrifice anything.
When you say 10 without interruption, you mean in terms of them going to air, right? In other words,
sequentially, week after week. It's like 10 weeks in a row, no breaks, no President Obama speaking or something like that. I mean, as far as one can anticipate that. But yeah, and so usually you'll get like, you know, 5, and that's a pretty good, you know, chunk of episodes that would go uninterrupted. And then, you know, 7 was a bigger number. So it's going to be a bit of a challenge. I mean, I think they've kind of reassessed it a little bit, and we might get a week, but it doesn't really do a whole lot. I mean, we don't stop and think, take a breath. Boy, we got some extra time. No. I mean, literally, I always say I'm like a one-legged man in a ass-kicking contest. You know, it's just like I'm working that fast, that hard. And because, you know, with visual effects, we're there at prep, we're there at shoot, we're there at post. And I'm juggling right now about between episodes that are officially getting underway. I've got 300-plus shots.
Because of the overlapping episodes. Because of the overlapping episodes, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, our second episode will be finishing next week. So we're finishing up all of the shots for that. And, you know, the low side for us is like 80 shots an episode. We're averaging anywhere from there to 140. So it's a lot, you know. I mean, I try to stay away from monitor comps, and we have a guy named Mark Markham at Chaos, his company, that does brilliant design and playback of many of the Shield graphics that we have. So we try to do almost all of those things live and only comp those kind of things when, you know, schedule doesn't permit shooting something beforehand. It's going to be either some kind of communication between, you know, one of the agents on location and you know, being on the plane and so on and so forth, or those kind of items. So you know, that helps to ease up and allow us to focus on the meat and potatoes of the visual effects, and not worry about a bunch of car driving comps or monitor comps and those kind of things. Yeah, I'm not saying we don't do some of them, just saying I'll let's keep those to a minimum and say let's do as much of that practical, and to which we are.
Well, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no, my pleasure. I'm glad to have spoken to you, and hopefully we'll speak again.
Well, thanks. Josh Whedon has such a great track record with compelling TV series, from Buffy to Firefly and Dollhouse, that I'm really looking forward to this series. Hey, have you ever noticed that FX Guide is not cluttered with ads on every page? Well, two things about that. We created FX Guide to be a site that we'd like to visit, and we hate cluttered sites where content fights with 75 ads for attention. And also, quite frankly, we'd rather create content than sell banner ads every day. So if you do want to advertise on FX Guide, use the Contact Us link on the site to reach us, and know that your ad will get noticed and not lost in the clutter. Also, we created the FX Insider membership program that offers insiders access to exclusive content and expanded articles. It's a way for people who care about visual effects and the work we do here at FX Guide to help us continue and grow. It's available at a very low yearly price. You can find out the details at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. You've been listening to the FX Podcast. As I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, we also produce two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases as well as classic films. And the RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. We also produce a high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. And as I mentioned, please take a moment to visit fxphd.com to see what we're up to over there. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.